Dear Secretary General, or SecGen in NATO speak, Secretary General, your delegation, a warm welcome in the oldest university in the land, Leiden University, 1575, for those who do not know that yet. Welcome in the City of Peace and Justice, The Hague, in the Faculty of Governance and Global Affairs. And the relationship between Leiden and The Hague, of course, is underlined by the presence of our Rector Magnificus, Professor Karl Stolker. Welcome, Rector Magnificus. Welcome, Karl. Welcome, Ambassador to Bosnia and Herzegovina. And more important, welcome, students, because this afternoon is about you. Secretary General, you visit the Netherlands in a time where peace and justice from time to time seems to be in rather short supply. The world of order seems to be shrinking, and the world of disorder seems to be spreading. You're leading the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, which during recent years has been forced to a strong focus on its core responsibility, keeping the territorial integrity of its allies intact and unchallenged, but also to continue to provide stability in parts of the world where that is deemed necessary. Secretary General, I know you're preparing for the July NATO summit. You should know that NATO summits are more exceptional than European Union summits, where we seem to have one about every month. NATO summits are special, and it is, by the way, also an important summit because it will be the first formal summit in the presence of the American President, Donald J. Trump. I hope that summit will reaffirm that the transatlantic relationship is a two-way street. The European allies should realize that stability and the rule of law does not come for free, also not financially. It should be nourished. Democracy, rule of law, human rights should be nourished and should be protected, and also in the financial sense. For our American friends and allies across the ocean, the message will hopefully be during that summit that they do not have better allies than their European friends sharing the same values. On that note, Secretary General, it is my great pleasure again to welcome you and to ask you to take the floor for your speech. And as you know, students, dear students, the Secretary General has kindly agreed for a Q&A, a question and answer session, which I will moderate after the speech of the Secretary General. Secretary General, may I invite you?
Thank you so much, and thank you for that introduction, Jaap. It's a great pleasure to be here for several reasons. It's a great pleasure to be here because it's a great honor to be introduced by you, a former Secretary General of NATO, and you were responsible, had a mandate when NATO actually had to respond to many difficult challenges at the same time. During your mandate, NATO was responsible for implementing, I think, the biggest enlargement of our alliance with many new members. Then we, as an alliance under your chairmanship, we acted in a calm but also firm and measured way to Russia's aggression against Georgia. And then also when you were Secretary General, we increased our presence in Afghanistan, conducting the biggest and most difficult military mission and operation NATO has ever conducted. So for me, it is a great honor to follow your footsteps and to meet with you and to be introduced by you here at the Leiden University. So thank you. Then the second reason why I like to be here is that I like being in the Netherlands, in The Hague and in this country. It's very flat compared to my own country in Norway, but despite that, I like it because I like the people, I like the culture, I like the atmosphere, and therefore it's always nice to be in the Netherlands. The only thing I really don't like with the Netherlands is that you have the bad habit of beating Norwegians when we do different skating races, for instance, in the Olympics. So if you don't, if you only change that habit, there will be nothing wrong with the Netherlands. The third reason why I actually like to be here is that I like academic institutions. I like the place, institutions, the buildings where scientific work, teaching is taking place. That's extremely important, and especially at a university like this, the oldest university in the Netherlands, it's a, I think it brings a lot of knowledge and experience, which is important for us all. And actually, I like academic institutions so much, so actually, I have only once really made a deliberate decision on what to become when I grew up, and that was to become an academic. So my big ambition in my life was to become a professor, as you have now become. So I don't know what you have done, but you have succeeded in what I've never succeeded, to become a professor. Because when I finished my exams back in Norway as the economist, and I remember we actually read some books of a Dutch professor called Jan Tinbergen, a great economist, and he actually won the Nobel Peace, not the Nobel Peace, but the Nobel Prize in economy, in economics together with Ragnar Frisch, a Norwegian economist. Then I decided to leave politics because I've been active in youth politics and student politics and do something real work, to start to do scientific work. And I worked in the research department of the Central Bureau of Statistics, working on econometrics and mathematics for 2 years. Then I was asked to become deputy minister in the Ministry of Environment in Norway. And I said, I will do it for one, maximum 2 years, then I will go back to this beautiful life of academics. I've been in politics since then. I never managed. Also, it's a disaster. My academic career is a disaster because I spent so many years in politics, and therefore I will talk to you afterwards, yep, and find out how you managed to become a professor, because that's actually the aim of my professional career. So therefore, since I've not been able to, what should I say, pursue an academic career, it's even greater to visit academic institutions and to have some kind of the atmosphere and to breathe in some of the air from academic institutions like this university. But the most important reason why I appreciate to be here today is, of course, that that provides me with the opportunity to say some words about NATO, how NATO is responding to a changing world. I will not cover all the issues, not all the items which are important for NATO and our security, because I will really try to not be too long, meaning that you have some time for questions and comments afterwards, and then you can raise the issues I don't cover in my introduction. NATO is the most successful alliance in history. And the main reason why NATO is so successful is that NATO has been able to change when the world is changing. For 40 years, since NATO was founded in 1949, and the Netherlands was one of the founding members, 40 years from 1949 to 1989, NATO actually only did one thing, and that was to deter the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And we did so quite successfully because we were able to end the Cold War without firing a shot in a peaceful way. And the Cold War ended when the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, and soon after the Soviet Union was dissolved and the Warsaw Pact was dissolved. And then people started to ask, do we need NATO anymore? Because in a way the reason why we were established, the reason why we existed, didn't exist anymore. The Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, didn't exist, so why should NATO continue to exist? And then some people also said that either NATO has to go out of area, meaning go out of the NATO territory, or NATO has to go out of business. And what we did was actually that we went beyond NATO territory, meaning that for 25 years from 1989, for 25 years, we were not so focused on deterrence, defense in Europe, deterring the Soviet Union or Russia, but we were focused on crisis outside NATO territory. First in the Balkans, we helped to end two wars in the Balkans, in Bosnia and Herzegovina and in Serbia, Kosovo. And we went to Afghanistan, where we helped to fight terrorism. We helped to fight piracy of the Horn of Africa, and our focus was outside NATO territory, mainly also outside Europe. Then in 2014, that's another pivotal year in the history of NATO and in the history of Europe and our security. Because in 2014, two things happened. The first thing was that Russia illegally annexed Crimea. That's the first time since the Second World War that one country grabs or annexes a part of another country, when Russia annexed Crimea in the spring of 2014. Then they also started to destabilize eastern Ukraine, providing support and also have some military presence in the eastern part of Ukraine. And they continue to do so also today. So that was a more assertive Russia in Ukraine, using military aggression against Ukraine. The other thing that happened in 2014 was that we saw a new kind of terrorism, and the stronger and more dangerous type of terrorism, we saw Daesh or ISIL. And I remember very well when I was asked to become, some consultations or questions whether I was interested in becoming Secretary General of NATO in January 2014, that was before anyone had heard about Daesh. It was only some few experts, and then some few weeks or months later, Daesh or ISIL controlled big parts of Syria and Iraq, 7-8 million people, a territory as big as the United Kingdom, and they were actually in the process of threatening Baghdad. So then NATO had to change again. And NATO has, since 2014, implemented the biggest adaptation of our alliance, the biggest change of our alliance since the end of the Cold War. And we have done that because, for the first time in our history, we have to both address collective defense, deterrence defense in Europe, but at the same time address the issue of projecting stability, stabilizing our neighborhood, fighting terrorism beyond our borders. We do that based on the core principle of NATO, which is one for all and all for one. We have in our founding treaty, we have something called paragraph 5, our collective defense clause, saying that if one ally is attacked, that will be regarded as an attack on all allies. And that's the strength. Because then also small countries know that if they are attacked, the whole alliance will be behind them. And the purpose of that, those security guarantees, so that collective defense clause, Article 5, is of course provide what we call credible deterrence. And the purpose of credible deterrence is not to provoke a conflict, but it is to prevent the conflict. Because as long as all potential adversaries know that if they touch or attack or are aggressive against one ally, the whole alliance will respond, then there will be no attacks. That's in a way the simple idea of deterrence. So the purpose is not, in a way, to win the war. The purpose is to prevent the war. And we have successfully been able to deliver that credible deterrence for almost 70 years. And that's perhaps the longest period of peace in Europe for almost ever, at least for hundreds and hundreds of years. Because NATO, but also the European Union, have helped to stabilize and prevent a military conflict in our part of the world. Now we need to deliver the same kind of deterrence, collective security guarantees, in a different world than we have done up till now. And we are responding partly by implementing a big reinforcement of what we call collective defense, meaning also our joint defenses. We have, for the first time in our history, we have deployed NATO troops, battle groups, to the eastern part of our alliance, especially to the three Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, but also to Poland, and we also increased our presence in the Black Sea region. These battle groups are not very big. They are around 1,000, each of them. The Netherlands is part of the battle group. You provide around or more than 250 troops to our battle group in Lithuania. As I said, well, around 1,000 in each of them. But the important thing with those battle groups is that they are multinational, meaning that Germany leads the battle group in Lithuania, the United States leads the battle group in Poland, the UK leads the battle group in Estonia, and Canada leads the battle group in Latvia, and then there are many other NATO allies providing troops. And by having combat-ready troops in the Baltic region along our eastern borders, we send a very clear message that if any of the allies are attacked, or any of these allies are attacked, then NATO is already there. It will trigger a response from the whole alliance. So that's the best way of providing credible deterrence, by having troops already deployed in these countries. Then we are increasing the readiness of our forces, meaning that if any ally is attacked, we're able to reinforce, to move forces to help and to support. We are doing other things, addressing, for instance, what we call hybrid threats, cyber, and adapting also in many other ways. I can go into more details afterwards if you want, but the thing is that we are significantly strengthening our deterrence and defense in Europe. We do that in a measured and defensive way, because we don't want a new Cold War. We don't want a new arms race, so we have to find a balance between being strong to deter any attack, but at the same time not provoke, overreact, and increase tensions unnecessarily. And therefore, we are pursuing what we call a dual-track approach to Russia, meaning that we are strong, we provide deterrence and defense, but we also work for dialogue. For us, for NATO, there is no contradiction between deterrence, defense, and political dialogue. Actually, we believe as long as we are strong, we can also engage in political dialogue with Russia. And that's exactly what we're doing, because Russia is our neighbor, Russia is there to stay, Russia will not go away, and therefore we have to continue to strive for a better relationship with our neighbor, Russia. And even if we don't believe it's possible to improve the relationship, we have to manage the relationship with Russia. We have more military presence, we have more exercises, we have higher tensions, and then we have to make sure that we don't have incidents or accidents. We saw the downing of the Russian plane over Turkey a couple of years ago. We have to avoid that kind of incidents and accidents, and if they happen, prevent them from spiraling out of control and creating a really dangerous situation between NATO and Russia. So we need transparency, we need predictability, we need dialogue with Russia to try to calm down and reduce tension and manage our relationship with our biggest neighbor. Then we are responding not only to a more assertive Russia, but also to the increased terrorist threats. Fighting terrorism is about many different means, or we need many different tools in the fight against terrorism. We need police, we need intelligence, we need border control, we need also social workers, teachers, addressing some of the neighborhoods in our own countries, where some of the terrorists are recruited from. And this, of course, is not a NATO responsibility, but it's extremely important in the fight against terrorism to do something with the root causes in our own countries that create extremism in our own countries. But there's also a role, and an important role, for NATO in the fight against terrorism. And that is to project stability, as we call it, or to address some of the conflicts which, is the breeding ground for at least some of the terrorists and some of the terrorist attacks that we have seen against our own countries. That's, for instance, why we are in Afghanistan. We have to remember that the reason why NATO went into Afghanistan, our biggest military operation, is a terrorist attack on the United States. And that's the only time NATO has invoked our collective defense clause, Article 5, was after the terrorist attack on the United States, 9/11/2001. And we have been there to prevent Afghanistan becoming a safe haven for international terrorists, a place where they can train, prepare, organize terrorist attacks against our countries. We are in Iraq. We do some training there, and also NATO allies are part of the global coalition to defeat Daesh. We work with countries in like Jordan, like Tunisia, and the aim is to enable them to fight terrorism. The message from NATO now is that, of course, we have to be able to deploy large number of combat troops in big combat operations as we have done before, for instance, in Afghanistan. But the message now is that more important than deploying NATO troops in combat operations, it is to enable local forces, train local forces to stabilize their own countries. Because we will always be foreigners. It will always be difficult to deploy Dutch or Norwegian or British troops in Afghanistan or in Iraq or wherever it is, because we will always be foreigners. So it's, in the long run, it's better if we are able to train local forces, build local capacity, build local institutions, and enabling them to stabilize their own countries and to fight terrorism themselves. That's the reason why we have ended the combat operations in Afghanistan. That's the reason why we have started to train, advise the Afghan National Security Forces, but also why we plan to do more training and advising in Iraq, because we have to make sure that ISIL is not coming back. The best way of preventing that is to enable the Iraqis themselves to avoid that, instead of us coming back and conduct big combat operations. Prevention is better than intervention, therefore we have to train the local forces. We are also responding to many other challenges, cyber, proliferation of nuclear weapons, what we call hybrid threats, and many, many other ways. And this is part of the broader adaptation and change of NATO, which is taking place. But my last message to you is that the world has become more unpredictable and more uncertain. In many ways, we live in a more dangerous world. Therefore, we have to invest more in our security, and security doesn't come for free. And I told the Defense Committee in the Dutch Parliament this morning that when I was Minister of Finance in Norway in the 1990s, I was responsible for cutting defense budgets. So I know how to reduce defense spending. And then people ask me, why can you argue in favor of increased defense spending since you, as Norwegian politician, were responsible for reducing defense spending? My answer is that when tensions are going down, when threats are reduced, then it's the right thing to reduce defense spending. As long as we are able to increase defense spending when tensions are going up. So yes, all European countries, the Netherlands, Norway, many others, they spent less on defense after the end of the Cold War. And that was right. I'm able to defend that today. As long as we are able to prove that we are able to increase defense spending again now when tensions are going up. And I welcome that the Netherlands has started to increase defense spending, but it's necessary to do more because we have agreed that we should spend 2% of GDP on defense based on the idea that we stand together and we all have to protect each other. So let me end by just saying that what has really impressed me with NATO since I became Secretary General is that it's not only 29 allies able to stand together, but it's actually 29 allies able to stand together and then change and adapt and respond when the world is changing. That was my introduction, and then I'm ready to take questions on all the issues I didn't mention in my introduction. Thank you so much.
Secretary General, thank you so much for this introduction. And now it's over to you guys, because Secretary General, as I said, has accepted a substantial Q&A. Stupid questions do not exist, as you know. Who is going to be the first and the courageous first? We go for ladies first. Please, go ahead.
I was just wondering, as the world is changing and NATO has to adapt to different things with the climate change and the melting of the ice caps, does the Article 5 apply to that situation where all the member countries have to like work together to solve that issue? Or what is your opinion on that?
Also, NATO is a military alliance, so NATO doesn't have the tools to address climate change. Having said that, climate change is important for our security, meaning that climate change will most likely lead to that people will start to move. It may lead to new conflicts about water, about agriculture, and it may also, you know, change, for instance, transport routes. I know that, for instance, many people are now looking into the possibility of starting, you know, regular commercial ship sealings, so sea lanes of transportation from, for instance, Antwerp or Rotterdam to Asia, not to the Suez Canal or around Africa, but over the North Pole or the Northeast Passage. Because the ice is melting. Climate change has security consequences, and NATO has recognized that in what we call the strategic concept. But to address climate change is about how to reduce emissions, how to develop cleaner forms of energy, how to make sure that we are able to protect the rainforest and develop technologies which allow us to drive in cars which are not polluting and so on. It's important that NATO allies engage in that, but it's not for NATO to, in a way, develop windmills or clean energy, because we have other institutions and organizations for that.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary General. I would like to ask a question, a very specific question, and it's about the tension between Turkey and Greece at the moment. And I would like to ask you, is it enough for NATO the fact that both countries are members of NATO? Is it enough for NATO in order for it to use it as a justification, as a justification for it not to take a clear stance on the issue when a country is breaching international law and is invading many times even within a day, is invading airspace and waters of another country member of NATO? Is it enough for NATO to use it as an excuse? Thank you very much.
NATO is the answer to many problems, but NATO is not the answer to all problems. Meaning that NATO is established. We have structures, we have mechanisms, we have forces which are assigned to and which are tasked to address threats from countries outside and from threats coming from outside the NATO alliance. I say this also because any decision in NATO has to be taken by consensus. So if we were going to do anything, we need not the majority of the allies to agree, but all of the allies to agree. And the only way we can have that kind of decision-making procedures is, of course, that we know that we will never be able to take a decision which is contradicting the interest of one ally. So when NATO was founded, the way we are constructed makes us unable to address disagreements between allies. So I accept that there are differences between Turkey and Greece. I have spoken with the Greek Prime Minister, I've spoken with the Turkish President. I've been briefed many times. This is about islands and territories and airspace in the Aegean Sea. And I recognize that this is a challenge. but it's not something that NATO can solve. It is something that has to be solved in the spirit of cooperation between Greece and Turkey, and I welcome that. I know that recently the Greek and the Turkish Prime Minister spoke, and I encourage them to continue to do so. But since NATO is an alliance based on consensus, it goes without saying that, of course, there's not much NATO can do when allies disagree, because we had to agree 29 to do anything.
I think there's another question there. Yes, please. And then in the back.
So recently the United States has ended the long war, the war on terrorism, or at least the Pentagon says so. And in the United States National Security Strategy in December 2017, and recently the Comptroller for Pentagon outlined in the budget that in the future great power competition will be the greatest security to United States security, and by extension NATO as well. So I was wondering, will NATO try to revise the nuclear strategy to accommodate great power competition rather than relying on Cold War bipolar strategies?
So first, the national security strategy is a U.S. strategy, but NATO believes that we need a strong nuclear deterrent, and of course we are constantly making sure that we have an effective and secure nuclear deterrent, meaning that we also nuclear weapons plays an important role in the deterrence I just described. We have conventional weapons, but we also have nuclear weapons, and we have to make sure that they are effective and safe and secure. And therefore, we will constantly assess what we have to do to make sure that that's the case also in the future. NATO's goal is a world without nuclear weapons, and therefore we believe in arms control, negotiations, and I think it's very important to protect those arms control arrangements and agreements that we have in place.
I think in the back, you're close to the microphone, yes.
European Union is also developing defense structures, infrastructures. How do you see that working together with NATO, and where does it conflict?
I welcome stronger EU efforts on defense, and we have to know that, we have to remember that the EU and NATO we have very much in common. We share much of the same territory in Europe. We share many of the same members. And more than 90%, actually 94% of the population living in the European Union, they live in a NATO country. So when NATO is strong, also the protection of European or EU members is strong. I welcome stronger EU efforts on defense, because I think that that can lead to more European defense capabilities, planes, tanks, drones, whatever, and brigades and divisions and different defense capabilities, which NATO has called for a long time. And if Europe is going to do more to provide that, we should welcome that. I also think that a stronger European or EU efforts on defense can help EU-NATO allies to work more closely together, which is also a good thing. The only thing we have to make sure, and EU leaders have stressed that many times, that they will prevent that from happening, is to see the European Union starting to develop competing structures and duplicate what NATO does. That will weaken our capabilities and our strengths. And therefore, as long as the European Union complements, not compete with NATO, as long as we don't see EU developing, duplicating command structures or structures in general, we should welcome stronger EU efforts on defense.
We're going to do something about the gender balance. Please, pass the microphone.
Firstly, thank you so much for your talk. And perhaps building on the question that was previously asked, and also on a point that you made in your speech, which was that NATO is a new or is a need for police forces. I was just wondering, what is the nature of the relationship between NATO and, for example, Europol and Interpol?
It may be that it was not my intention to say that NATO should develop police forces. If I said that, that was a mistake. Because NATO is not, we're not responsible, or we will not develop police forces. But of course, we work with allies and institutions. For instance, when it comes to exchange of intelligence, because we have so many threats, which requires partly military response and partly response from police. And I think I refer to the need to have police in the fight against terrorism. But those police forces will not be provided by NATO. They will be provided by NATO allies, but in their national capacities, or, for instance, by Europol. So we work with these allies, addressing common threats and challenges. But NATO is, in a way, looking outwards. National police will then look inwards at each and every NATO ally.
Next, the microphone is already with you. Yeah.
First of all, thank you very much again. I was wondering, since he got into presidency, Donald J. Trump has expressed that he's not that much into NATO anymore. And I was wondering, how is NATO planning on dealing with the possible threat of Trump of leaving the alliance, seeing also that the United States is the main financial contributor to it? Thank you.
So NATO is an alliance of 29 democracies, and different political leaders are elected, representing different political parties, coming from different countries with different political cultures, from the right to the left, and we are different in many, many ways. And that's, for me, not a weakness, but actually a strength. Because we have proven that despite those differences, we have always been able to unite against or around the core responsibility of NATO, and that is to protect each other. And President Trump has clearly stated that he is committed to NATO. This has also been supported by his security team, Secretary Mattis, and all the other people surrounding him, which gives him advice on defense and security. But even more important than words and commitments and language on support or providing support for NATO is the fact that the United States actually now increases its military presence in Europe. After the Cold War ended, the U.S. Gradually reduced its presence. During the Cold War, the United States had 300,000, more or less, troops in Europe. Then after the Cold War, it would gradually reduce to 60, 70,000. Now the United States and the last U.S. battle tank left Europe in December 2013. Now the U.S. is back with not one battle tank, but with the armored brigade. They invest heavily in something the U.S. called the European Deterrence Initiative. I think it's $5-6 billion U.S. dollars for equipment, for training, for supplies, and for more military presence. And this is happening now. So actions speak louder than words. So not only has Donald Trump expressed his support to NATO, but he has also proven that by more spending, more presence, more exercises, more U.S. military personnel in Europe. And when I met President Trump in the White House last spring, he declared at the press conference that NATO, he used to say that NATO is obsolete, but NATO is not longer obsolete, he said. So that's a clear message.
I'll go for one more in the back. I have tens of questions. So, Secretary General, if you agree, I'll cluster a few. So first we go to the back there, lady back, and then we come to the center. And I have two gentlemen here, and then later we'll see. Please.
Thank you. I was wondering, what's your take on Finland joining NATO?
Sorry?
It's working.
What you think of Finland joining NATO due to increased tension with Russia? Would Russia take that more as a threat? Or
yeah.
That would clearly provide security to Finland, but would it be, for NATO, would it be actually beneficial or not.
Okay, please.
I'd like to ask you about 2% defense budget policy, and how do you see the trend after 2014, and what NATO itself can do against it?
Thank you. And final question in this round. You both have a question? Okay. You get the opportunity. First yourself, and then you. Okay.
Thank you. First, I thank you so much for that to come today. You. You
I beg your pardon?
That's a beautiful Norwegian language.
I see.
You mentioned with respect to the recent or to the developments in the Arctic, and also you mentioned how NATO has increased its presence in the East. My question is about NATO has a relatively small presence in the North, particularly Norway, and now after 20 years, there's finally a major operation or exercise, the Trident Juncture, is being held in Norway. And so what's the significance of this, and to what extent do you believe that NATO should increase its presence in Norway and Northern Europe in general?
Please send the microphone, then final question in this round.
Thank you for giving me the final question, and thank you for your talk as well. My question was originally going to be about EU-NATO cooperation, but now a little bit more specifically, we were told during a visit to the European External Action Service that occasionally intelligence sharing between NATO and the EU does not run as smoothly as it ideally would. For instance, in the case of Turkey and Cyprus, who are respectively a NATO and an EU member state, but now vice versa, their disagreement, politically speaking, hinders intelligence sharing on an institutional level. So a lot of different actions have to be taken by experts and ministers just to make sure that all member states of the both organizations have all the intelligence that they need. So how would you envision that being solved or working out on the longer term? Because that is obviously not ideal or sustainable.
Secretary General, please.
First, on Finland, the answer is that's for Finland to decide whether they want to join NATO or not. And if Finland decided to apply, then of course we would so assess that consider that application, and then it will be for 29 NATO allies to decide whether we would deem or consider Finland, as I say, qualified to become a NATO member. I think very much we will. Finland is a very advanced country, so I think that will not be a big issue. But the main issue is whether Finland would like to apply. That's for Finland to decide. So far, Finland has clearly expressed that they appreciate very much a strong partnership. We work closely with Finland. We have exercises. We work with them in different ways, and Finland contributes to NATO missions and operations in Afghanistan and elsewhere, but Finland has clearly stated that they are not interested in applying for a membership. The important message is that Russia or any other third country do not have a say in whether Finland should join or any other country should join NATO, because it is an absolute fundamental principle that each and every sovereign nation has the right to choose its own path. So the whole idea of big countries having some kind of right to decide what small neighbors can do, that's a very dangerous idea. So the idea of kind of spheres of influence around big countries denying, for instance, Finland or Norway the right to join NATO is violating fundamental principles when it comes to the sovereignty and independence of all nations. The 2% spending. Well, we are moving in the right direction, meaning that when NATO allies back in 2014, after the illegal annexation of Crimea and the rise of Daesh, decided in September 2014 to stop the cuts because we gradually increase and then move towards spending 2% of GDP on defense within a decade, then actually we were only three nations meeting the 2% target. Now we are eight. And also those who are not at the 2% target, they have started to move. All allies have increased defense spending in real terms. So I'm not saying that everything is fine, but I'm saying that after years of decline in defense spending has started to increase.
And that's, we have turned a corner, and the picture is still mixed, but much better than it was just a couple of years ago. And we didn't promise 2% within the year. We promised 2% within the decade. And we are really moving in that direction. So we have, it's a good start, what we have seen since 2014. Then on the Arctic, we used to say that in the high north, we have low tensions. And I would like to continue to work for that being the case. Because we have seen increased Russian presence. We have seen more naval presence, more submarines, more exercises. But at the same time, I think it's important that we try to keep the tensions low in the high north. And we also see some cooperation with Russia within the framework of the Arctic Council. But as a Norwegian, you also know that Norway, actually, being a neighbor of Russia, we work with Russia on many different areas. When I was prime minister, I remember we negotiated with Putin and with Medvedev on a delimitation line in the Barents Sea. We agreed that delimitation line up in the Barents Sea, in the Polar Sea. This is a continental shelf, potentially a lot of oil and gas. We agreed the line. We worked together with Russia on fisheries, managing a big common cod stock, on environmental issues, border issues, search and rescue, and so on. So I believe that we should continue to engage with Russia up in the high north. It's in our interest and in Russia's interest. But the message is the same, that we have to be firm, we have to be capable of delivering credible deterrence, and therefore NATO also need more, for instance, naval capabilities. Also the new F-35s are critical for the presence of NATO in the high north. NATO is present in the high north because the Norwegian military presence in the high north is NATO in the north. Then, of course, we need more. We have some Danes. There are several places in the north. So Norwegians like Danes, we were a joint kingdom for some years, and we have some kind of different views on that, how that was. Then, of course, we have Canada, United States, Great Britain, and we have all allies, but not with big military bases, but with the capabilities to deploy forces, to project power, if needed, also up in the high north. Then it was this question about intelligence. No, there are some challenges the majority of EU members are also NATO members. And many NATO members, actually the majority of the NATO members, are EU members. But not all EU members are NATO members, and not all NATO members are EU members.
Please write that down.
Yeah. You understand. So the thing is that you have Norway being member of NATO but not being member of EU. You have Austria or Finland, Sweden being member of EU but not member of NATO. And therefore, there are some challenges related to, for instance, how to share in intelligence. But we have found practical ways of sharing information. We have, for instance, a NATO presence in the Aegean Sea helping to implement a agreement between Turkey, a NATO member, and the EU on the migrant and refugee crisis, helping to stop the flow of illegal migration. And there we work together with Frontex, and we have been able to find pragmatic, practical ways of also sharing information. So we haven't solved all the problems, but I think that a pragmatic approach both from the EU and NATO, respecting the sovereignty and the decision-making integrity of both of the organizations have enabled us to work together.
All right, Secretary General, thank you so much. I see in the back, and then we'll cluster again. I see many fingers, but we'll wait and see. Please go ahead.
Mr. Secretary General, thank you very much for your speech. My question concerns Turkey.
and the changing dynamics in the Middle East. So we have seen after the low peak of the downing of the Russian jet, improvement in the relationship between Turkey and Russia in recent times. And in December 2017, there has been the, let's call it, scandal of Russia buying S-400 systems from, of Turkey, sorry, buying S-400 systems from Russia. What's your take on that and NATO's take on that, and how do you see the future development in the relation between Turkey and other NATO allies? Thanks.
Second finger I saw there. Yes, please.
Yes, thank you for coming. And well, my question pertains to the Skripal case in the United Kingdom and, well, the use or illegal use by international law of the Russians of chemical weapons on British subjects. And how, and is that not, does that not trigger Article 5 for NATO?
Thank you so much. I see a third question here.
Yes, some of my friends think of Russia as this big enemy of the West, and by experiment I visited the country last summer and was surprised to find that a lot of young people there are very nice and similar in thoughts about good government and everything. So my question is, how can NATO improve the more informal relationship between Europe and Russia?
You pass on the microphone, then we have another question here.
So there's been a lot of talk about whether, to what extent NATO should concern itself with terrorism, with all these new challenges emerging. And I was wondering what your view is on how much international coordination is necessary in that field, and maybe reflecting on your own experiences in dealing with a terrorism attack against Albert Spatia in IOF, which was very much domestic.
Mm. Final question this round here in the front, please.
Thank you from my side as well, Secretary General. I'm wondering if you could tell us more about strategies of NATO against Russia's influencing strategies, which are apparently happening all over Europe. So, for example, the use of social bots and adverts on social media, or the funding of right-wing parties, because these are not necessarily physical military threats, but they could be on another level when they undermine trust and legitimacy of countries. Thank you.
Thank you. Secretary General, please.
Thank you. First, on Turkey. Turkey is an important ally because I think, I don't know if Olde said that, but Turkey is important for NATO for several reasons, not least because of its geographic location, bordering Iraq and Syria, and it has been a key ally in the fight against Daesh, where we have used Turkish airports, infrastructure bases, to conduct airstrikes and other operations against Daesh. Turkey is also important because Turkey has suffered many terrorist attacks. No other NATO ally has suffered more terrorist attacks than Turkey. And of course, Turkey has the right to address these legitimate security concerns. And what we have conveyed is that we expect that to be done in a measured way and in a proportionate way, and also in a way which is in accordance with the rule of law. And that's an issue which has been discussed many times with also the Turkish authorities. Then on the S-400, which is an air defense system, as you mentioned, that's a national decision. So the requirement of military capabilities by different NATO allies is not a NATO decision, that's a decision by each and every NATO ally. What matters for NATO is whether this system is going to be integrated in what we call the integrated NATO air defense, where, you know, we link the different air defense systems, we link the radar, we share information. That's extremely difficult to do with the S-400. And it has also been clearly stated by Turkey that this is a system which they don't foresee integrated in the NATO integrated air defense system, and there's been no request for integration of the Turkish system into the NATO integrated air defense system. On the Skripal case, all NATO allies have strongly expressed support to the United Kingdom. We have reacted in a coordinated way. NATO allies, EU members expelled Russian officials after the use of a nerve agent in Salisbury. That's the first time a nerve agent has been used on NATO territory. And I live in Brussels, not far away from Flanders. And in Flanders, 100 years ago, we saw the horrific effects of chemical weapons, when chemical weapons were used in the First World War. And a few years after that, we had the first international ban on chemical weapons, and we also have now a convention on prohibition of chemical weapons. And one of the reasons why we reacted so strongly after the attack or the use of chemical weapon, nerve agent in Salisbury, but also after the use of chemical weapons in Syria, where three NATO allies conducted airstrikes against the Syrian chemical weapons facilities, was that we have to uphold the ban on chemical weapons and not accept that the use of chemical weapons is normalized or accepted. NATO has to respond in the proportionate way and a measured way. And it's serious what happened in Salisbury, but it's not an attack or an incident which requires Article 5. We have to remember that we have invoked Article 5 only once, and that was after the 9/11 attack where thousands of people were killed in the United States. We don't trigger Article 5 every time there are serious incidents or that kind of attacks, as we, for instance, have seen in Salisbury. But we will continue to provide support to the United Kingdom, and we will continue to support the ban on chemical weapons, and that's also the reason why we take so seriously what happened in Syria. Then on Russia, I think that first of all, I think it is important to convey that when we criticize Russia for their behavior in Ukraine or their support to the Assad regime or their development of nuclear weapons or whatever we criticize them for, it's important to underline that we criticize the policies of the Russian government. We don't criticize the people of Russia. Actually, I know many Russians. During my life as a Norwegian politician, I met Russians in many different capacities, working with them on many different issues, also people-to-people contact. Again, referring to Norway, up in Norway we have something called the Barents Cooperation, where we have visa-free travel for people living along the borders, on the Russian side and the Norwegian side of the border. And I believe in contacts. I believe in people-to-people contacts, and I believe also in trying to avoid any kind of demonization of other countries. We disagree. We criticize them. We are firm, but also measured and defensive, because Russia is our neighbor, and we have to continue to strive for a better relationship with Russia. International cooperation. Yes, of course, we need international cooperation in the fight against terrorism, and we need it on all levels. We need it, of course, when we work together in the coalition to defeat ISIS or Daesh. We need it in Afghanistan. We need it in Iraq, and we have a lot of international cooperation in NATO, but also in, for instance, the global coalition to defeat ISIS. And we have been quite successful. So we have achieved a lot. We have to remember that not so many months ago, Daesh controlled big parts of Iraq and Syria. Now they have lost almost all the territory they controlled. That hasn't just happened. It has happened before because a lot of NATO allies and other countries have devoted a lot of capacity, military resources, soldiers, planes to defeat Daesh. But of course, we need also international cooperation in many other areas. I mentioned police, intelligence and so on, which is partly outside the NATO responsibility. Then, was that all? Cyber?
Perhaps on cyber?
Oh, disinformation, yeah, sorry. Yes, of course, that's something we take very seriously, because what we see now is that we have what we call hybrid threats. Before, it was very easy to define peace and war. For instance, I think that's the same for the Netherlands as for Norway. When we speak about the war in Norway, we speak about the Second World War, and we knew exactly when it started, and we knew when it ended, and we knew when it took place. The war in Norway started the 8th, then the 9th of April, and then it ended in 1940, and it ended the 8th of May. And then Norway, Denmark, Netherlands, we were part of that war. Sweden and Switzerland was not. So it was very clear the difference between peace and war. Now the problem is with hybrid threats, is that it's a much more blurred line between peace and war. It's hard to say. For instance, it's very hard to say when did the war against Daesh start. And it's very hard to say, and to be honest, I don't expect that we can have a date where we celebrate that we ended the war with Daesh. And it's actually also hard to say where does it take place. We all know that it takes place in Iraq and Syria, but it also takes place in our own streets, in Asia, in Africa, and in cyberspace. So that's what hybrid threats is all about. This blurred line where there's a mixture of military, non-military use of aggression, disinformation, cyber, covert operations, and all that. And therefore, NATO has to be able to respond also to disinformation. We do that and propaganda. I believe that the best response to propaganda is not propaganda. The best response to propaganda is the truth. And the truth will prevail. Of course, NATO and NATO allies, we can provide facts. We can counter when we see that there is disinformation being also presented. And we do that. We have teams, we have people who share the truths and the facts when we see that this information is presented in different ways. But perhaps the best tool against disinformation is a free and independent press. Is to have journalists, media, newspapers, TV channels, which ask the difficult questions, who are able to check the sources, and to ask all the difficult questions to make sure that we have the truth and not propaganda presented to us.
Secretary General, thank you so much on behalf of all of us, not only for your speech, but also for the open and frank way you have answered all the questions, almost all the questions, because there were many more from our students. Thank you so much for it. We wish you all the very best in your all your activities in NATO, more specifically, as I said, preparing a very important summit in the second week of July. So, you know, I'm going to give you a small token of our appreciation, remembering cufflinks of Leiden University, remembering that when President George W. Bush gave me cufflinks, he said, Secretary General, here are cufflinks, but I don't want to see them on eBay in a few days. I know you're not the person to do that, neither am I, but as a token of our appreciation, cufflinks of Leiden University, and thank you ever so much for having come.
Thank you.
And I would ask the students to remain seated for a moment, because we do a bit of Leiden promotion and we make a picture with the Secretary General and I think with the Rector in front of you, so that we can see that you're real students. Yes, we do it here. You stay where you are. Secretary General in the middle. We do it like this. You should. Okay. Thank you so much, and once again, a round of applause for the Secretary General.